Air pollution is an age-old problem. Air pollution, visible air pollution, has appeared to increase in some cities, while it's decreased dramatically in other cities. Up in through the Second World War, London had terrific visible air pollution. They were burning lots of coal. The coal put particulates in the air, which gave wonderful nuclei for a fog to form on, and pictures taken in London show just this opaque fog that hung in the city. On the other hand, the kind of air pollution that we're talking about is a higher in the atmosphere air pollution, not as high as some of the other problems that air pollution has, such as the carbon dioxide levels in the ozone. But it's always interesting to talk about what we actually mean by pollution. We all have some sense of what that word means. But in an official kind of a definition, all we mean is that it has some adverse effect on the environment. And it may be a very visible effect. It may kill off vegetation, or it may simply have harmful impact in an aesthetic kind of a sense. And so in some ways we can think of the tailings here as being a form of pollution. It just has some adverse impact on the environment, the wrong composition, the wrong color, the wrong smell, or whatever. But what we're going to be talking about today is acid rain. And it probably ought to be called instead acid precipitation, because it's not only in the form of rain, or acid deposition, because in fact it's not only in the form of liquid material, but it also includes dust particles. And we'll come back and talk about that a little bit more. But the whole issue is that what we're doing to our atmosphere is putting certain gases up in the atmosphere, in particular the ones that we abbreviate scientifically by the two notations here, SO2, which means sulfur and oxygen combined, or nitrogen and oxygen. And here it's one sulfur to two oxygen. Here we use an X because there's a number of different forms of nitrogen that are put up there. Nitrogen with a single oxygen or nitrogen bound with two. Nitrogen as a molecule of simply two nitrogen atoms together actually comprises about 80% of our atmosphere, the normal atmosphere, and oxygen is less than 20%. But it's nitrogen, when it's combined with oxygen, it then makes it much more susceptible to combine with water. And we can see this equation, which is written then in chemical jargon here, for how we form sulfuric acid. What we're concerned about is that by putting our sulfur and nitrogen gases up into the atmosphere, that we then allow the formation of acid. And acid is basically hydrogen combined with these other gases. And so we look and we see if we take our sulfur gas and we put oxygen and water with it, we end up by very simply creating sulfuric acid. And we could write a similar kind of equation for creating nitric acid, both of which are major problems in terms of the atmosphere. Now, when it comes back down to the surface of the Earth, we want to have some scale to measure how acidic something is. And we have a scale called the pH scale. It's measuring, basically, you can think of sort of as the percentage of hydrogen atoms in a solution, because hydrogen combined with our gases is what gives us this acid. And basically, the scale ranges from 0 to 14. Things which have very low numbers are considered to be very acidic. Things which have very high numbers are considered to be very basic. And after I show you a few examples, you'll see that both ends of the scale are quite caustic or abrasive types of materials. So that it's only when we're close to the middle that we're in something which is neutral, and pure distilled water is something neutral. Now, this kind of a scale is what we call a logarithmic scale. And that means that each increment from 0 to 1 and 1 to 2 is actually 10 times greater than the previous level. So that we look at the number 0 to 14 and think, oh, well, you know, we're just increasing up there in sort of an easy fashion. But in fact, if we have something that has a pH of 5, it is 10 times as acidic as something with a pH of 6. And something with a pH of 5 is 100 times as acidic as something with a pH of 7. So that's quite important when we look at some examples of what the pH level is of certain materials. Now, we all know that battery acid is such excrete substance to come into contact with. And you can see it has a very low pH of 1, very acidic. And similarly, lye is not a great substance to come into contact with either. And here it's at the opposite end of the scale. It can be just as harmful a substance, but it's very basic instead of very acidic. Ammonia is very basic. Soapy water is up at the basic end of things. You can see that there's a lot of very normal things that we deal with in life, which are on the fairly acidic end of things.
Is that Coke, like Coca-Cola?
You bet. I love to give this lecture in class because I love to point this out with Coke, as half the students are sitting in the room with a can of Coke. Very often they're sitting in the room with a can of Diet Coke. So they don't have the 16 teaspoons of sugar that are in a normal can of Coke, but instead they have whatever it is as an artificial sweetener. And I point out that if you're drinking regular Coke with 16 teaspoons of sugar and you look at what the pH or the acidity level of Coke is, you better think it's not doing such great things for your teeth. I mean, we know that lemon and vinegar are very effective cleaning agents. If we don't want to use some store-bought cleansing product, we can use these, and it's very effective. Coke is obviously very effective in that way as well. But interestingly, apples are also down at this level. Now, normal rain, you can see, is already more acidic than our neutral 7. It's here at about 5.6. And so what the problem is that we are now getting deposition throughout the world at levels lower than this normal 5.6 pH. And we'll talk about what some of the examples are and what some of the actual numbers are. What we're getting down now in much of the country is rain, which has a pH somewhere between 4 and 5. So, I mean, we're only down at the level of wine. We haven't dropped down too dramatically for that. But in fact, there have been some very severe episodes. In Baltimore in 1981, rain fell that had a pH of 2.7. And in California in 1986, there was fog with a pH of 1.7. So episodes like those are the ones that are really quite serious to consider. Well, the question is, where do these gases come from? And as in so many of these quote-unquote environmental issues, it's real important to remember that there are natural sources for whatever process is going on, as well as what we call anthropogenic or sources that result from human activity. And in particular, we put lots of sulfur gas and lots of nitrogen gas in the atmosphere every time we have some form of volcanic activity, whether it's a major kind of an explosion or whether it's simply lava coming out, because these types of gases are contained in the molten material in the interior of the Earth. And so we have always had normal rain being something lower than neutral because these gases are present in the atmosphere. But the issue now is places where we observe very high concentrations of these gases, it's not happening through particularly natural sources, although we may have it in a unique instance of some major volcanic explosion, but the ongoing high concentrations are then the result of human activity. And about two-thirds of the problem that we see from acid rain comes from the sulfur gases, and I have a pie diagram here which has various atmospheric gases. We're only interested in the two I've circled here in blue. The sulfur oxides here, the SO2, and then the nitrogen oxides, the NOXs. And you can see that most of this, to about two-thirds of the problem in the atmosphere of acid rain comes from the sulfur gases, and you can see most of those sulfur gases then derive from the burning of fuel in a stationary position. And what we mean by that is in power plants. And we're talking about the burning of oil and coal primarily. Now, why is sulfur present? Well, sulfur is present in all of our bodies as an element. It's an essential element to make our cells function, to make our entire bodies function. And so the organisms that died to be incorporated either into oil or coal then also contain sulfur in them. And so what we're doing is simply burning up what was once organic tissue and releasing from that the carbon, as in the carbon dioxide we have in the atmosphere, And then also the sulfur, and similarly nitrogen is also part of our bodies, very important in terms of the reproductive capabilities of our cells. So most of it comes from what we think of as power generation in terms of burning gas, oil, and coal. Some of it comes from industrial processes. And you can see that in the case of sulfur, really only a small amount, percentage of it comes from transportation. And by that, we're talking about planes and cars and trains and buses and things like that. On the other hand, nitrogen gases, which contribute about a third of the problem related to acid rain, almost half of that comes from transportation processes. And we'll talk a little bit about that sort of when we come back to a discussion of what kinds of things we as individuals can do. Nitrogen gases are observed in smog. They are they produce a reddish brown gas, and so a lot of what we see in city smog are these nitrogen gases. When they get up into the higher atmosphere, they then can go through this process to become part of the acid deposition. Now, the story about coal is an interesting one, and we'll come back to it again. But just to show you a little bit about what happens in the formation of coal and what happens, how that relates to sulfur. Basically, what we have when we have coal is plant matter, which has been buried and not really given a chance to decay. So in burial and compression, it goes through a series of states. The first state is simply that it becomes peat. I mean, that's basically compressed and dried plant matter. And then as it undergoes further and further compression, it goes to various stages of lignite, bituminous, and anthracite. And as we move along in this process, in the formation of the different stages of coal, what we do is concentrate carbon. We basically are forcing out the things like the hydrogen and the oxygen that were part of that plant tissue. And as we come down to anthracite, we find that the amount of energy that comes from burning a volume of material increases as we come to something which is purer and purer in the concentration of just carbon. Now, unfortunately, accompanying that process of going from the low grades of coal to what we think of as the high grades with the very concentrated carbon, we also happen to be concentrating the sulfur. The sulfur does not get removed from the system in the same way that the oxygen and hydrogen do. And we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about what I mean by here, but basically we find the low grades of coal, the low carbon and low sulfur coal in the western part of the U.S., and the high grades of coal, the high carbon and hence high energy, and also then high sulfur coal in the eastern part of the U.S. Now, once these gases end up in the atmosphere, our sulfur gases or our nitrogen gases, they actually can stay there in the atmosphere for 2 to 5 days. And this then is important in terms of the story of where the acid deposition takes place. It is rarely, it rarely occurs where it is put into the atmosphere. Atmospheric transport around most of the world moves eastward. So when we look at the patterns of acid deposition, we'll see that the burning takes place in one place and then the deposition is in another. As I said, this isn't a recent phenomenon. In Europe, and particularly in England over a century ago, scientists were starting to measure the pH of rain and precipitation and discovered that it was much more acidic than what they had observed previously and what they observed on a more average basis, and there were then these small intervals. Now, as I said, this acid deposition can come back to the surface in a variety of forms. It can come as rainfall and it can come as snowfall, and those are the two dominant ways, because what we have are the gases in the atmosphere and then the gases combine with water as the water condenses in the atmosphere to form clouds and ultimately precipitation. Also can happen as dry deposition, in that particulate matter containing the sulfur and the nitrogen will fall to the surface of the earth. And the problem then is that once the particulate dust is on the surface of the earth, it can combine with water to form the very acidic material. To look at a map of the United States, and we'll come back and look at this one actually again, basically what we have is that the burning of the fuels takes place in one location, and then the acidic deposition takes place in another location. As I said, most of the travel of the atmospheric circulation is from west to east. And this is true not only in the United States, but also true in Europe. And what we have in the US is most of the burning of these fossil fuels taking place here in the Midwest, and yet the acid deposition is taking place in the regions further into the Northeast, and also further on up into Canada. And similarly in Europe, it's the eastern portion of Europe and Scandinavia which are feeling the effects of acid deposition, and not the western margins of the continent.
What we see in Oregon and Washington coming clear across the ocean?
No, it can be local. And actually, I'll come back and talk about what the shaded areas mean. They're related to sort of the susceptibility of a region more than anything. Now, it's not unique to what we think of as the very well-developed countries. The lesser developed countries are the ones that are almost entirely dependent upon coal and oil for their sources of energy. And China, for example, has many, many coal plants, small coal plants which burn, and they have a terrific problem there as well with acid deposition. Now, an interesting map. What the lines on this map are showing is what the level, the pH of the rain is in various regions of the country. You can see that basically here in the west, we have the highest numbers, 5.3, and then as we head eastward, the numbers decrease up to something in this region actually here, 4.1. But a more regional study in the northeastern part of the United States shows a comparison of the acidity measured in 1955 and then in 1987. The different lines contour then what the acid deposition was in sort of belts around the central core of very low numbers. In 1955, this region within this area had a pH of 4.6 or lower. And I've taken the map here in 1987 and highlighted the same red line to show the 4.6 level. And you can see that here in the region that had pH of 4.6, we're now down to something 4.3 and 4.2. And one of the other things this points out is not only have we dropped to lower values in terms of the acidity, but we've also increased the area which is being affected. So that only this area had the low pH of 4.6, and now it extends out over the Great Lakes and almost down to Florida. So something is going on, which is accentuating the problem and making it worse through time. Now the US has been very slow to pick up on this problem. It's become very newsworthy in the last couple of decades. In Europe, the concern for it arose much earlier, because of the types of effects and the impact of acid deposition. And that's the next thing that I want to talk about, is what actually can result from acid deposition. What we have is something coming from the atmosphere down to the surface of the Earth that is far more acidic than the normal situation. And we think of that as abruptly influencing or drastically influencing the organisms. But in fact, it tends to be a progressive kind of thing. And it's not that the acid itself always influences the organisms, but the acid may have an impact on the environment in which the organisms live and somehow change the chemistry of that environment to no longer make it hospitable for the organisms. And in the case of soil, when the acid deposition falls on the soil, there's a couple of different things that happen. Very often, small scale or microorganisms are affected directly. They're so small that the acidity is absorbed into whatever tissue they have, and then it will kill the organism. That then has a much greater impact on the larger organisms. The microorganisms are often the bottom of what we call the food chain. Larger organisms feed on them. So that the fish may not be affected directly by the acidity, but may lose their food source. Another thing that happens in the soil is that the soils can be leached by the acidity. Water, which has a low pH, has the ability to, as it flows through the soil, to extract things which are part of the solid material. And some of what gets extracted are what we call the nutrients. And the nutrients are essential for the growth of the plants and hence for the other organisms in the food chain. But the other thing which can so easily be leached out of the soils are metals. And aluminum is one which is leached very easily. And it's not a problem for the soil to have the aluminum leached away, but it then becomes a problem as that water flows through the system. It now contains much higher concentrations of aluminum. And I think news in the last few years and decades has brought to our mind that there may be some very serious health problems related to too large a concentration of aluminum for humans in particular, and we could understand that that may also affect smaller organisms as well. But one of the things that happens is that the acid deposition will have different levels of effects depending upon the rock type which is involved. It turns out that rock that we call limestone, which is composed of calcium and another ion called carbonate, which is carbon and oxygen together, makes up limestone, and limestone actually is a very good substance to neutralize an acid. And so in areas where there's a large amount of limestone outcropping at the surface, they tend not to be as affected by the acid deposition because the water has so much of this dissolved limestone in it that it then neutralizes the acidic deposition and it isn't as serious a problem. But in contrast to that, granite, which is a rock formed by processes of molten material coming into the interior of the earth, cooling and crystallizing very slowly, granite, when it's finally exposed to the surface, is already a little bit acidic. And so in regions where there's a lot of granite exposed, the waters are already somewhat acidic from the erosion of that granite. And then if acid deposition takes place there, it makes the waters all that much more acidic. And so what the shaded areas on this map show are the areas which are susceptible to acid deposition. And a good example here is this region of the Sierra Nevada Mountains in California. What they are is a huge, what we call a batholith of granitic material, which through millions of years of erosion is exposed at the surface, and it's then already somewhat acidic, and this region then becomes much more acceptable. And similarly, the cores of the mountain ranges, the coast ranges, and the Cascades also contain rocks which are more acidic than limestones and things like that, and so it increases the susceptibility. Similarly, the core of the old mountain range of the Appalachians, which runs up this way, contains rocks which are more acidic, granitic type rocks, and so it increases the susceptibility in that region. In contrast, Texas, for example, contains abundant limestone exposed to the surface. So there's something there which can offset the acid deposition. One of the areas that is often referred to as having serious problems in terms of acid deposition is this area of the Adirondack Mountains in New York State. And again, this is an area where material of a composition close to granite is exposed. And so the waters are also already more acidic than in other areas. Now this is a problem right here. Holton Village. The mine tailings contain a lot of sulfur in them. The mineral that was being mined in this area was a copper ore that was a combination of iron and copper and sulfur together as a mineral. In the extraction process, a lot of the sulfur debris ended up piled here in the tailings. As normal rainwater falls on this region, as it leaches through the rock, it removes the sulfur from the rock, and the pH of Railroad Creek has been very low compared to what it was prior to mining. how many people here have been up to the door to the mine, the portal to the mine? What do you see flowing out of that portal?
Nasty water.
You see water. Why do you say nasty water?
Containing a white deposit.
It's all white. Do you know what that is? That's limestone that was put into the creek to offset the acidity from the mine tailings. So that limestone is not a problem at all. In fact, it was put there in the last couple of years purposely to counterbalance the problem from the mine itself. And Railroad Creek, if you look at the bottom of Railroad Creek, and I haven't really been down to an area where you can see this very distinctly, but in the leaching process, because so much sulfur is leached out of these mine tailings, it picks up a lot of iron from the mine tailings as well. And there are places in the bottom of Railroad Creek where all of the rocks and pebbles are cemented together by an iron coating. And that's because of the acidity of the water. And then hopefully by having added the limestone to that water that flows out of the mine portal itself, it will help to neutralize and bring the acidity of Railroad Creek back to something closer to neutral and normal. So your immediate reaction is it looks awful what's flowing out of the portal of the mine, but that's purposeful. And that white is just what we call calcium carbonate. I mean, it's not a harmful substance at all. So the problem the susceptibility to acid rain is a problem as we look at the surface. Different areas, because of their composition already, will have a different reaction to whatever the level of precipitation is. And we get effects directly on the soil. We then get effects on different other sorts of things in terms of plants. The acid precipitation onto the plants themselves will not only affect them from the root systems upward, but can affect them downward in terms of the precipitation. It can turn them brown and ultimately destroy any of the vegetation which is there. Pine trees are particularly susceptible to nitric acid. Nitrogen itself is a nutrient very essential to plant growth, and what happens is that if too much nitrogen is put into the system, it causes the plants to grow too fast. And pine trees are particularly susceptible to this. They grow too fast, and then the tissue is not strong enough to withstand whatever kind of climate changes may occur on even an annual basis. And so they become much more susceptible to the winters and can die off. And the West German forests are ones which lots of pictures have been shown of, where the pine trees are entirely stripped of vegetation there because the acid deposition has been going on for such a long time. The estimate is that about 52% of the West German forest, and I actually don't know what that number is to compare with the East German, but at the time that number was put out in 1985, they were looking at West Germany, and 52% of the forests were either damaged or destroyed. In Switzerland, about 43%. In England, the number was up as high as 67%. Now, in the eastern part of the United States and Canada, pine trees are very susceptible, but another tree which is very susceptible to it is the sugar maple. And somehow the chemistry of this plant itself makes it one which can be harmed very easily by the acid deposition. So simply in terms of the plant cover, but agriculture as well can be affected by acid deposition. And one of the things that we have to remember in thinking about all the organisms is often the young stage of that organism, whether it's plant or animal, is extremely susceptible. And in the case of agriculture, a lot of grain crops, it's the bud which can be harmed. And so the plant is actually harmed before it has a chance to grow to fruition. Now, most of what we hear about in terms of acid deposition is the Adirondack Lakes, and that's been the big story. But lakes are a real problem. Lakes are a place that are a catchment for a lot of water that flows through the ground and over the surface, having a chance to leach out materials, having a chance to accumulate all of the acidity from a whole basin area. And in these lakes, the acidity has been measured, in particular in the Adirondacks. The pH of the lakes in this region of the upper part of New York State was measured in the 1930s, And the pH in this, in about 300 lakes ranged between 6 and 7.5, so very close to neutral. The same set of lakes were measured in 1975, and all of them had a pH of less than 5. So a dramatic decrease for all of them. And 25% of those lakes, which had been measured in the 30s, were then devoid of fish. Concentration of the sulfur and nitrogen, but most of all, it is the larval stages of the fish which are so susceptible. The few cells in the larval stage just simply do not have enough organic tissue to sort of buffer them against the very acidic water. The Norwegians were some of the first to notice this link between the acid deposition and the decrease in fish populations. They noticed this as early as 1959. And in Scandinavia at the present time, it's estimated there's somewhere about 20,000 lakes which are now devoid of fish. One of the other things that happens is that in water, in streams and in lakes, the acidity has a very cyclic nature to it over the year. In particular in areas where snow accumulates, because as the snow accumulates, the acidic material ends up on the surface of the snow, and it's not until the snow melts off in a big pulse that the acid is then carried into the drainage system. And so the surface, which has this buildup over the winter months of the acidic material, it melts in a rapid pulse in the spring, and it then flows into the rivers, streams, and ultimately into the lakes. And the problem with this is it often impacts the organisms during the beginning of a reproductive season when they're most susceptible. And it's been measured that pH during the first rapid melting in spring can be as low as 3 or 3.5. So while the lakes are only at a level of 5, there is this one pulse which is much lower than that. In terms of the water, which may have more direct impact to us, as I said, we end up having some of this water flowing through the ground, becoming part of what we call our groundwater, which is then the resource pumped up to the surface for human consumption. And because it's more acidic, it can be very effective at corroding pipes. It may have already done a significant amount of leaching as it passed through the groundwater sediments and may have picked up an abundant amount of aluminum. And having, I referred to the aluminum before, that may then end up back into our drinking water system. If it hasn't already picked up a lot of aluminum and you happen to cook in aluminum pans, using acidic water, tap water, will then corrode those aluminum pans. Some of the most dramatic pictures which have been taken of the effects of acid deposition, aside from those that show trees which are just stripped of their greenery, are taken of buildings. And limestone is very effective at neutralizing the acidity. Limestone is then very susceptible to the acidity. As the acid deposition falls on buildings which are made of limestone, they corrode to then neutralize that acid. And so a lot of very ancient buildings and sculptures have been harmed very dramatically. The Taj Mahal is one, which is shows drastic effects from acid deposition. The Parthenon is another. The Parthenon was always up there for people to go and hike all over until a few years ago when they really had to rope it off because the surface of it was just corroding from the effects of the air pollution.
You said it even gets the marble too.
Yes, that's right. Well, what marble is simply limestone that's been buried and compressed, but the composition is identical to limestone. So.
You think it would be harder and more resistant, though, but
compositionally, I mean, it may be denser, which makes it seem harder and more resistant, but the composition is identical to it, so. Yeah?
Is it possible for the rain water to leach to the soil and pick up other basic solutions that will neutralize it?
Yes, if they're there. But the trouble is that organic matter is already slightly acidic. And so soil tends to already be slightly acidic. And there isn't, other than soils derived from limestone and so on, there usually isn't much, which is
so
basic.
So it's more often that it picks up, like aluminum makes it more acidic.
The aluminum does not affect the acidity one way or the other. It's just susceptible to being picked up by it. And metal is also, not only in the case of aluminum, but other metals are very susceptible. And railroad tracks are suffering very dramatically from acid deposition. Because once again, as the iron is being leached out of these tailings, the iron gets leached out of the steel that's in railroad track. Another thing which is affected is clothing on clothesline. And the story related to that acid rain that fell in the Baltimore area, that was whatever it was, 2 point something, in the early 1980s, anybody who had clothing hanging on their clothesline came out to find holes in their clothes in the rain. Oh, God. So, real thrilling.
Was that like a brief rain? Would you get that kind of like pulse at the beginning of a rain and then?
You know, I don't know how it would change over the course of a rainstorm. It is easier to perhaps understand how a single rain that occurs after a long dry period may be more acidic. But I don't know if the storm itself will change so much, because the condensation may have all taken place about the same time, and then it's just falling gradually. So I don't really know how the rainstorm itself will change. A lot of health impacts, human health impacts. It appears that the incidence of heart disease and lung cancer, and then various respiratory problems such as asthma, pneumonia, and bronchitis, show a direct correlation with the areas that have more acid deposition. Particularly affects the elderly and children, and it's estimated that somewhere in the order of 100,000 deaths per year directly related to acid deposition in the United States. All of those kinds of things that we talk about are aesthetic or sort of human impact, but there's a very dramatic economic impact to these. A lot of this region of the country and up into Canada has a lot of tourism, which has been based on fishing. And as these lakes lose their fish life, the economic impact to the surrounding communities is very large. In addition, as crops are affected, as timber is affected, and so on, it really will have serious effect on the economy. Now, some of the things which have been suggested as possible solutions to this are to consider burning other substances, or to consider burning coal, which is lower in sulfur. This map shows the distribution of coal resources in the United States, and unfortunately, the lignite should be over here. I don't quite know why they have these sort of out of order, but you remember that lignite was very low-grade coal, low carbon concentrations, hence low energy and heat, but also low sulfur, whereas anthracite was the opposite end of the scale. It was the high-grade coal, producing lots of energy, also containing a lot of sulfur. And then lignite subbituminous, or sort of one end, and bituminous and anthracite at the other end. And what you can see here is that the resources of the higher grade coal are concentrated in the Midwest and the East, whereas the resources of the lower grade coal are found in the more western part of the United States. Well, where is most of the coal burning taking place in the United States? Well, most of it happens to be occurring right here. Why? Because there's a lot of coal there. It's accessible as a resource. It has a short distance of transport. They do not have hydropower as a resource there and in the way we do in the West, and so they use the coal. Well, the suggestion is, why don't you go ahead and use the lower grade coal, which contains less sulfur? And there's a number of problems which are raised, one of which is simply the transport. If your resource is here, but you're going to bring it in from here, then you got to pay an extra cost to bring it to these regions where it's being burned. And then the other argument is that you put all sorts of people out of jobs from the economic side of it, because there's a huge amount of the economy which is dependent upon the mining of the resource here. Even if you're still burning coal here, but you're bringing it from someplace else, then the people who burn here are all out of jobs. So the coal story is one which is quite complicated in terms of the effects on acid rain.
Would you not only have to burn more to get the energy and
yes,
heat you want?
That's
so
right. That's
more,
right.
You end up using less sulfur.
That's right. No, you will not end up with having as much sulfur.
because you can still, because the sulfur concentrations to heat are not directly parallel, but still, that's right, you have to use more of the resource. Now, one of the things which happened with the Clean Air Act of 1970 was to try and improve ground level air quality. We were all very aware of poor air quality in our cities. We could see it as visible smog. And so one of the things that happened was that smokestacks were built taller on power plants and industry in order to get it up above the level where it became part of our ground level air. A lot of smokestacks now reach somewhere, and power plants in particular, reach somewhere over 1,000 feet. So what are they doing now with these gases that are coming from the burning of coal and oil? They're simply putting them up higher. If we put them up higher, they're then that much more susceptible to being transported by the atmospheric circulation across the continent. And the saying which always goes along with this was that they always thought that sort of dilution was the solution to ground level air pollution, was that you put it up higher and you let it be diluted in the atmosphere. Unfortunately, all it means is that that pollution has the opportunity now to travel further from the source. And so what we have is the burning taking place here of the coal, but the acid deposition then is traveling to the eastern part of the country, rather than being felt right around where the burning is taking place. And this is one of the big problems in coming up with any means to control acid deposition, is that the people who are affected by the acid deposition are not necessarily those which are contributing to the pollution on the very large scale. Now, that's not true so much on the local scale. And Canada, who is being drastically affected by acid deposition, is burning very little of this in comparison to the effects that they're feeling in their forests and lakes. Various other things which have been suggested are to actually put what we call scrubbers on the smokestacks to remove the nitrogen gases and the sulfur gases from the emissions. These are very efficient systems, up to about 95% efficiency, but they are extremely costly. And so it takes a phenomenal amount of legislation to get them to be required and to be used. In the case of automobiles, and remember that a large part of the nitrogen gases resulted from the combustion of fuel in transportation systems, your catalytic converter is on your car specifically to remove the nitrogen gases from the emissions. I know a lot of people who like to take their catalytic converters off because it increases the fuel efficiency of the car. But unfortunately, they were put on there for a purpose which has a longer term effect than simply how much money is in your pocket in terms of buying gas. Now, a couple of other things is that leaded gas contains more of the impurities of sulfur and nitrogen that will then end up out in the air. And diesel gas also is much higher in concentrations of those. So on simply a personal level, to reduce the amount of emissions that we're contributing from the transportation system, to make sure that we use unleaded gas as opposed to regular and diesel.
Why is there this myth around that diesel is so low polluting?
I have no idea. I've never heard that myth. I thought diesel was simply being used because the efficiency of a car, I mean, it took fewer gallons of diesel to drive the same distance.
It's the type of particulate that diesel is less emitting as a whole. Carbon monoxide is almost non-existent.
But other things are not almost non-existent. I mean, I drive behind a diesel car and I can barely breathe.
You know, smell it.
The rationale that's given for diesel is that the particulates are heavier and that they settle to the ground rather than.
Oh, good. And then they can get picked up by the runoff and put in the streets.
That's the argument that was used where you must have your pollution equipment checked for gasoline fueled vehicles, but not diesel.
Anyway, diesel engines produce less carbon monoxide, infinitely less than gasoline engines. They do produce some similar oxygen, nitrogen oxide, and they do produce more sulfur.
they produce more particulate. And they produce much less unburned hydrocarbons, so it's trade-offs. Yeah. So you're trading one thing for another. So to say that either is better is they both have their problems.
Right.
And also they tend to stay in tune better.
Diesel I mean, cars?
Yeah. Although they do smoke.
Although they do smoke. They sure do.
But the smoke is not directly toxic. You could turn a diesel engine on in this room and let it run all day. And
right.
Anyone's going to die.
Because the carbon monoxide.
Carbon monoxide
issue.
Don't smell good.
Yeah,
yeah,
really.
So you
drive
the
smoke.
No, you won't die.
The diesel
is
just carcinogenic.
Not the soot itself, but the theory is the soot contains enough voids in it by which it could pick up other things to make it a problem. The soot is carbon, in the sense it acts a little bit like a sponge.
Now, legislation has been ongoing in various, both in our country and within states, and then also globally. There was an Acid Precipitation Act passed in 1979 with directly in an attempt to identify sources and to evaluate the effects of acid deposition. And the sort of consensus is that not a lot has come out of that, although money was spent. In 1984, a group of nations came together to try and form what they called the 30% Club in an effort to reduce emissions of the acid-bearing gases by 30%, aiming for this in sort of a decade's time. And there were 19 nation members. However, the United States, as well as the United Kingdom, both refused to join because they said it was scientifically uncertain that there was this correlation between the emissions and then acid deposition. Obviously, a lot of this is very much affected by whoever happens to be in government at the time. Some states have then taken on this law themselves and passed it in an effort to try and reduce emissions in those states. New York, because they feel so drastically the effects of acid deposition, has passed this, and Minnesota was another one that was cited. The U.S. in 1988 ratified an international treaty, not the 30% treaty, but another one that was looking directly at the nitrogen gases, and they were going to attempt to limit them to 1987 levels. But unfortunately, the general consensus is that this was A, too late, and B, too little in terms of the goal, that by 1987 we were already at quite drastic levels. I think that from a personal standpoint, we individually can have some effect on this in terms of our consideration of simply our energy use and then also in terms of legislation. And when I talked about energy a few days ago, we talked about various energy conserving measures, and that's something that we all could talk about again here if people wanted to sort of open this up to discussion in terms of things that you as a person or I as a person can do to help in a small scale, and more unfortunately on the transportation side than on the large industry side. And so we more of the nitrogen gases than we would the sulfur gases. But I'm sure everybody here has something creative that they do to help in terms of energy, whether it be walking or keeping their tires inflated in their car.
I think in Minnesota, though, that emission control is just in the Twin City area. I don't think it's over
what, this 30% goal?
No, the emissions control system that they've been enacted now.
For cars?
For cars.
But they have to pass inspection, but only in the Twin Cities area. How many states here have, how many people come from states that have emission control required on their car?
Again, it's partial.
In Oregon,
it's partial. It's partial too.
Yeah.
How many people here are from California? How many here from California? And there, it's statewide.
Statewide.
Yeah.
And
you drive your car and it hooks it up.
It's probably effective. We all write about it. It's keeping
that's right. Although there's one thing that's interesting.
It's keeping having
lived there and having owned old cars from the early 1950s, they're exempt.
Yeah, but even Unocal has said, I'll give you
$700 and bring your wreck in. Give you $700 on the spot one time.
Right.
Just to get them out of there.
Right. So I think it is effective in terms of cars that were made in the last couple decades. And so in terms of the general population, I think it's effective. Unfortunately, as you see cars driving down the roads, it's often the much older ones that have the black smoke coming out of them, and they aren't necessarily influenced by it.
You have to do it every 2 years. Right?
Yeah, and it's interesting, how many people know about the California law? Emission control systems on California cars are much stricter than they are in any other state in the country. But B, if you do not pass the emission control test, you have to spend only a maximum of $65. Isn't that right?
50
or something. So that you don't have to junk your car. I mean, and if you then fail the next time, you have to spend an additional amount on it. But you're not having to spend thousands to bring a car to standards. But it's very interesting in that state. You can't, if you buy a car out of state and move into state, within 6 months of having bought that car, you have to pay to bring the car up to standards. It's very interesting, some of the laws that exist.
I'm trying to remember, but I can't. Do they test the cars for diesel and regular?
I think so.
Is it all in one? I think there were two divisions
that
we had to drive from one. I can't remember if that diesel was separate.
What? Do you know the
answer? What was the question?
Diesel versus the regular engine?
No, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure of California, but in Washington, diesel is excluded. And I think it's obvious why, because the majority of diesel vehicles are commercial trucks, and that's a strong lobby.
That's right.
It all takes back to the fundamental of where the engines respond. Diesel engines, again, are putting out some more sulfur because it's in the fuel. And that's not controllable unless you control the fuel. So there's no tweaking of the engine. I mean, they're putting that out. They're not putting out what's driving the emission controls in the gasoline engines have been like carbon monoxide, which is deadly. It's been unburned hydrocarbons, which cause a lot of the smog and the NOx.
Mm-hmm.
But diesel engines inherently are better in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's driving it, the soot issue is probably the most obvious, but it's not necessarily a significant
isn't picked
help.
Up in those kinds of tests.
Yeah.
Problem.
Or it would be picked up, but it's not necessarily the significant health or environmental problem that the NOx,
it's working.
The CO, and the unburned hydrocarbons are. So it's a different set of problems.
If a person is building a new house or installing a new furnace, generally have a choice of maybe a gas furnace or electric. Is either one of those substantially worse or better in terms of contribution to acid deposition?
Hmm.
If you buy electric, obviously they have to burn coal or something.
Someplace else, that's right. Gas is usually considered to be a very pure resource to be burning. You know, gas smells, but that's an added smell. I don't know how many people know that. Natural gas, as it seeps out, has no smell. And then they add the sulfur gas to it in just a small enough quantity to be able to smell it. And if you had to pick a choice between burning natural gas, petroleum, and coal, gas is usually considered to be the cleanest of all of them.
A lot of our electric power comes from hydroelectric.
That's right. And this comes back to some of what we talked about the other day when some people were here in various sessions. I mean, where you live in the country is, you know, it, due to whatever situation you're in, but your power source is dependent very much upon where you live. And if you were going to be living in the Northwest, there's been strong encouragement to go to electric because the hydropower is available, because it's cheaper, and so on. And yet there's now some encouragement and incentive to go to natural gas in the Northwest.
Gas is cheaper. Gas is cheaper. Our home is cheaper.
Now it is, that's right. And because gas furnaces are efficient in that respect.
And mm-hmm. also all new sources of electric power, because there's been a great move to cut off future hydroelectric dams mm-hmm. because of their problems, has all future really be thermal dependent. And when you take in order to get a BTU of electric heat, you got to produce 4 BTUs of thermal heat. It's the laws of thermodynamics. Therefore, it probably makes less sense to use electric heat.
You can also use a heat pump so that for every BTU of electric heat, you pump back in 3 or 4, whatever it is.
Yeah. If you use a heat pump, then you essentially cover that back.
But it's very interesting. Our neighbor has it. We live in a house built in 1920, and our neighbor lives in a house built at exactly the same time. They're for 2 different brothers. And our house has gas heat in it. And last winter, I mean, I don't know how many people live in the Puget Sound area to have experienced last Christmas time, but temperatures were really cold for a while. And they had taken their gas furnace out. No, theirs had never been converted to gas. It was still oil. They had taken their oil burning one out and put a heat pump in, and they were able to keep their house warm enough with the heat pump.
Not a big enough unit.
Yeah.
Yeah, efficiency drops off and gets closer.
That's right. And that's the problem with the heat pump. So it's often necessary to have something else to supplement that. So
usually, by the time it's cold enough to really want some heat, it won't work. Mm-hmm. It's almost, as I see it, ridiculous.
Yeah. If you go to places like Sweden or Northern Europe, it's very interesting. They will take their coal plants. They'll take the hot water coming off the coal plants and run that as heating districts in their communities, more energy efficient. They're even talking nuclear plants to do that. Also, they use a lot of heat pumps running out of their lakes.
Yeah, we stayed with some people that the guy had his heat pump coils in the ground down where it's only 55 or so.
Okay. Also, when they site wastewater treatment plants, they fight over the siting of tremendous bitter battles. So who gets the wastewater treatment plant? Because you take your hot shower in the morning or in the evening, that water goes someplace. Mm-hmm. So the wastewater plants will be running 50, 60, 70 degrees Fahrenheit, excellent source of heat pumps. And then they put in very large heat pump installations and use that heat then for large commercial people.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how many people heard the Iceland talk. Of course, that's what's being done in terms of a natural resource in Iceland is pumping the hot water that's been in contact with the lava, but to be able to use the water which was generated by human means is also very smart.
How much of a problem is the fireplaces in people's homes?
Oh, there are a lot of a problem. If you live in Puget Sound, you can't burn.
I know there are bans on burning days.
Quarter or a third of the year, that's right.
Is that contribute to the upbringing problem, or is
that the... That's more the carbon dioxide problem, and also then some of the low-level visible pollution.
What about field burning? Where I live, there's about this time of year for the next month, right. The countryside ablaze. Right. Is that acid rain problem?
Well, it certainly contributes to it. I actually don't know the specifics of what sort of the annual correlation would be with that. But when you're burning up that organic tissue, you're putting nitrogen and sulfur gases into the atmosphere. And you're doing it in a big pulse. So,
you know, there was a very, very comprehensive federal-funded study, an EPA-funded study, of the effects of acid rain, conducted over a number of years by scientists from many universities across the country. And there was I don't know if you're familiar with that, but there was I read a couple of articles. This was, I think the study was finished a couple of years ago. And, as I remember the bottom line, I can't remember all the details, but it seemed like the impact wasn't, quite as extensive as what you were describing. And I just wondered if you're familiar with that.
Well, I've seen some articles which I think are offshoots of that study, but I mean certain sources show things like the maps. I mean the whole process of taking this ore and smelting it was burning up was processing a mineral that contained sulfur in it. So you take, and you what you want is the copper, and one of the byproducts you get is the sulfur, and what you had coming up out of that smokestack in Tacoma was a lot of sulfur gas for years as you burn up that ore.